It's a great pleasure and privilege for me to be here. Steve and I go back a long time, and over that time we've had many personal and philosophical contacts. So this makes it all the more special for me to be here. And I'm really sorry I couldn't be there in person. And also I'm sorry that I missed yesterday's session, but this is a very busy time of the term for me, and so it just simply wasn't possible. This is a talk on self-reference, and I always thought that self-reference was possible, but it was as a result of conversations with Martin Pleitz and actually subsequent conversations with Andrew Bacon that I realized that there were problems in the very idea of self-reference. And although I actually still do think that self-reference is possible, I also think that it's a lot more problematic than people have supposed. So what I want to do in this talk is to explain why this is so. Steve, of course, wrote a very famous note on self-reference, and he gave an example of a paradox of truth that didn't involve self-reference. I'm sure you're familiar with this paradox. It involves an infinity of sentences, S1, S2, S3, and so on. And each sentence says of all of its successors that they're not true. So there's no obvious senses of self-reference. And yet this sequence of sentences gives rise to paradox. I want to make two observations about this paradox of Steve's. One, I'm sure, has been made before, though I don't, someone perhaps tell me if it has. The observation is this, that Steve's case involves what you might call ill-founded reference. That is, we have S1 referring at least indirectly to S2, S2 referring indirectly to S3, and so on. There's an infinite chain here. I would have thought that the hypothesis of self-reference, I think Steve's example shows that self-reference isn't necessary for paradox. But there's another hypothesis that stands, which is that having an ill-founded referential chain is necessary for paradox. And in fact, I think something like this could be proved. That is, you could easily set up a formal language where there isn't ill-founded referential chains, which would not be subject to paradox. You have the usual truth scheme and everything. You know? So the second observation is this, that and it will relate to the first. By the way, I should mention there's a handout. So I've given the summary of Steve's paradox and the Yablon paradox of that self-reference, and then there are the two observations. So occasionally I will make reference to the handout, and I'll try to say when the handout is relevant. I've got a quotation here from Steve under two observations, number two. Not that self-reference suffices for paradox. Such a view is refuted by the work of Gödel and Tarski and by various common sense examples. And actually what the view we'll be considering is that this isn't right, that for there to be a counterexample, we have self-reference but no paradox, we actually need self-reference. And the view I'm considering is one in which there is no self-reference. And in fact, the view I'm considering will not only rule out self-reference, it will rule out the kind of ill-founded referential chains that Steve's talking about. So it would actually, it would also block, for similar reasons, his paradox. Okay. All right, so let me begin with the talk proper. Let me start with a quotation from Kripke's Outline of Truth. And this is in the handout, and I will read it out in full. So a simpler and more direct form of self-reference uses demonstratives or proper names. Let Jack be a name of the sentence, Jack is short. Now, I'll often be talking about expressions that are in quotes and so on. Sometimes it'll be obvious that I'm talking about expressions in quotes, so you have to go along with me. Sometimes I'll just say quote. Okay, so And so, okay, so let Jack be a name of the sentence, Jack is short. And we have a sentence that says of itself that it is short. So now Kripke goes on to explain why that is so. I can see nothing wrong with direct self-reference of this type. If Jack is not already a name in the language, why can we not introduce it as a name of any entity we please? In particular, why can it not be a name of the uninterpreted finite sequence of marks, Jack is short? Would it not be permissible to call the sequence of marks Harry, but not Jack? Surely prohibitions on naming are arbitrary here. So if I can call this sentence Harry, why not call it Jack? There is no vicious circle in our procedure, since we need not interpret the sequence of marks Jack is short before we name it. Yet if we name it Jack, it at once becomes meaningful and true. Okay. Actually, the real killer there is that last remark. It once becomes meaningful and true. I'm actually later going to say that Tripp is right. It does at once become meaningful and true, but it's highly problematic to suppose that it does at once become meaningful and true. I'm actually now going to read from this paper I have, which is sort of half finished, but some of it's in reasonably good shape. Now, what Kripke says here might appear to be self-contradictory. Oh, I should mention, my wife, Ruth, is holding a thesis defense in this apartment at the very same time. And so you may hear interference from time to time. Let me know if the interference becomes too much. We'll try to do something about it. Okay. So now what Kripke says here might appear to be self-contradictory. For before being named, the sentence Jack is short was uninterpreted. As Kripke calls it, he says it's a sequence of marks, suggests that it's uninterpreted. Of course, part of it is interpreted. Short and is are interpreted, but it's the Jack part that's not interpreted. And of course, people are called Jack, but he's supposing the sentence is one in which where the word Jack is not being interpreted. There might have been a Jack in the audience, but he's not thinking that person is being named here in the sentence. It would be somewhat unfortunate if it were and Jack was actually tall, because Jack might have taken it to be some kind of offensive remark. Okay, well, might then have thought that once it was named Jack, that is, this sentence was named Jack, Jack would be a name for an uninterpreted sentence. That is, we have this uninterpreted sentence, at least partially uninterpreted. We now name it Jack, and the natural thought is that Jack would be a name for the uninterpreted sentence. That's what it was. That's what we had, an uninterpreted sentence. I name it Jack. So Jack should be the name of that uninterpreted or partially uninterpreted sentence. And yet Kripke takes it to be a name for an interpreted sentence, one that is meaningful and true. Now, so that's the problem with this quote. Now, if the uninterpreted and interpreted sentence are not one and the same entity, so there's a question here. I'm talking about the interpreted sentence, the uninterpreted sentence. What am I talking about when I talk about these things? One view is that they're not the same, that the interpreted sentence is distinct, a distinct entity from the uninterpreted sentence. Then there is indeed a problem. For how, in naming one thing, can one succeed in naming something else? I have this uninterpreted sentence before me. I name it, and lo and behold, it becomes a name for the interpreted sentence, which is thought to be distinct. There's a mysterious process going on here. By naming one thing, attempting to name one thing, I succeed in naming another. In fact, I didn't even succeed in naming the thing I was aiming to that I seem to be naming. I actually succeed in naming something else. But if the uninterpreted and the interpreted sentence are one and the same entity, and what changes is the status of that entity from being uninterpreted to being interpreted. So it's the same entity here, but this naming process serves to change the status of that entity, the sentence being uninterpreted at one time to being interpreted at subsequent time, the problem goes away. For the ceremony of naming simply serves to change the status of this entity, not its very identity. Some people will be aware, I won't go into this, that this kind of dispute is very familiar. So I think Steve uses the term one fingers and two fingers, the statue and the clay. The one fingers think there's one thing there, the two fingers think there are two things there. And the question here is whether we want to hold a one finger or a two finger view about the sentence. Okay. I'm not really going to go into that that analogy, though I think it's a pretty close analogy. It also appears easy to see how this might come about. So I'm saying there's no problem, but it's also easy to see how this sort of naming might be successful. For prior to the naming, we may reasonably assume the words short and his have already been interpreted, while Jack has not. There is then nothing to stop. So we have this interpretation. That these are in themselves uninterpreted symbols, but there's meant to be this interpretation. Maybe we have it in our minds or whatever, or maybe it's just given, maybe society has it. It doesn't really matter. There's this thing called the interpretation. There is then nothing to stop us from extending the interpretation of these words to which Jack is to be the name for the previously uninterpreted sentence. Jack is short. And under the new interpretation, Jack then becomes a name for a sentence which, under that very interpretation, is meaningful and true. So what naming does here is update the interpretation. Okay. And it's updating it to one in which now the object assigned to Jack is the uninterpreted sentence that Jack is short. Okay. So on that view, there seems to be no problem here in what Kripke is saying. This approach to the issue presupposes a certain conception of language and of the expressions of which it is composed. It is one in which a name does not in itself have a referent, or a sentence does not in itself have a truth value, but only relative to an interpretation. Thus, under one interpretation, it may have one referent, and yet under another interpretation, the very same name may have a different referent. We might call this a formal conception of language, both because it's characteristic of the treatment of formal languages, where we start off with some interpreted symbols, and then the interpretation is given by sometimes something called an interpretation or a model, which is external to the language. And also because it's a conception of language in which these expressions are regarded as formal objects. Formal simply in the sense of not bearing themselves an interpretation. This conception of language stands in contrast to another conception of language and its expressions. This is a conception under which a name can be said to have a reference simpliciter, not relative to an interpretation or anything like that. Or a sentence can be said to have a truth value, simpliciter, without any appeal to an interpretation or the like. So whereas under the previous conception, we might have said that the name Jack referred to a particular person under one interpretation, and to a sentence under another interpretation, there would, under the present conception, be two names spelt Jack, with one referring simpliciter to the person and the other referring simpliciter to the sentence. We might call this a natural conception of language, both because it's characteristic of natural languages and because it is a conception of language that we naturally adopt. Thus, homonyms, such as bank in the sense of financial bank and bank in the sense of riverbank, are naturally taken to be two words, not one word subject to two different interpretations. We might also note that the natural conception of expressions is presupposed in many philosophical theories of the meanings of names. For example, according to millenism, to which Kripke subscribes, the meaning of a proper name is its bearer. But since there are many people called Jack, this presupposes that the respective names of all these people must be distinct. So ironically, even though Kripke states in the cited passage that reference may be achieved through the use of proper names, his own theory of proper names seems actually to prevent it being achieved in the way he suggests. I said it would work if we had this formal conception of language, but he's saying by using proper names, we can get it, but proper names, his view of proper names presupposes this natural conception of language. Okay. So I'm probably in danger of going way out of time. So what I do is I talk about the question I now have is this, not, okay. Or maybe I should read this. We might distinguish between the two conceptions of language in terms of the way in which the expressions of a language can be said to be interpreted. Under the formal conception, expressions are intrinsically interpreted, The interpretation is extrinsic to the expression and serves merely to assign a meaning to it. Under the natural conception, by contrast, expressions are intrinsically interpreted. The interpretation is intrinsic to the expression and thereby serves to endow the expression with meaning. Okay. The interpretation of the expression under the formal conception is somehow absorbed into the very identity of the expression. This is a natural way of thinking of things. So I'm going to use the phrases interpreted expression for an expression that is intrinsically interpreted, not extrinsically. I'm going to use it for an interpreted expression, and I sometimes say I, an I expression. And a U expression is one that hasn't been intrinsically interpreted. So it is, so to speak, a mere sign. Okay. So my question now is whether self-reference is possible for I expressions, for I names. That is, well, I call that semanticized self-reference. So it's not a question about the uninterpreted symbols, but about the interpreted symbols and whether we can achieve self-reference in that case. Okay. And what I'm saying is the procedure that Kripke outlines gives us self-reference for uninterpreted expressions. I just have no doubt about that. But it's not clear that it gives you self-reference for interpreted expressions, what I've called I expressions. So that's the question. And really what I want to say is that self-reference in this sense is possible, is a very substantive position. There's no easy route from the one kind of self-reference for uninterpreted expressions to the other. And we have to take on board some substantive semantic assumptions. Indeed, the theory of meaning actually is going to look very different once we accept this sort of thing. Okay. So I'm willing to take the leap myself, but there's a leap here that needs to be taken. Okay. Actually, when did we begin 5 minutes late? So maybe I have an extra 5 minutes. I realize I'm going to be running out of time. Let me carry on. It might be thought there is an easy way to go from syntactic, that is the one involving these extrinsic interpretations, to semanticized self-reference. For example, the U name, that's the uninterpreted name N, we are given that the U name N refers to X under the interpretation I, we might suppose that the I name, okay, so now when I refer to the U name, I use light face. When I refer to the I name, corresponding I name, I use bold face. So there's Jack light face, which is the U name. And then there's Jack in bold face, which I use for an interpreted version of Jack. So I'm going to talk about bear Jack for the uninterpreted expression and bold Jack for the interpreted expression. Okay. So we've got bear Jack. And bear Jack, under an interpretation, refers to a certain sentence, and then you might think, well, bold Jack can be taken to, what we can do is put together, forge a marriage between bear Jack and the interpretation to get bold Jack. Okay. But this won't work because then bold Jack, and this is the problem we face, we can do this, we can get bold Jack in this way by wedding bear Jack to the interpretation. But bold Jack is then going to still refer to the bear sentence, not to the to the bold sentence. Now, this is a hypothesis I played with, which I don't think really works. But for a time, I thought this was perhaps a way to go. However, it might be thought that there's no reason why the derelativization, I call this derelativization, because the relativity is now built into the object. It might be thought there's no reason why the derelativization of the referential claims for I expressions should be a one-sided affair. After all, given that the cat Felix is on the mat at time t, we feel justified in inferring that Felix at T is on the mat at T. at least given that there are such objects as spherics at T and mat at T. So here, this is a two-sided derelativization. Okay. So why shouldn't we go into a two-sided derelativization in this case as well, given that bear jack refers to this bear sentence under the interpretation? Why shouldn't we say that that then justifies us to say bowl jack, that is, jack wedded to that interpretation, refers to the bold sentence, that is the sentence wedded to that interpretation, just as with Phoenix and the mat. Okay. Attractive as this solution may appear, it is one in name only. What we require of a satisfactory solution, not merely that it provides us with some objects and some relation that behave in the same way as I named and the relation of reference, we don't want just to simulate what we're interested in, but it should actually be possible to regard the objects as genuine I-names and the relations a genuine form of reference. And neither of these requirements would appear to be met in the present case. For we want to be able to regard an I-name N, that is, bold N, as somehow the result of attaching the meaning to the corresponding U-name, bear jack, bear N. Now, there are two natural requirements on the meaning that is so attached. So the question is, if we think of the semanticized name as a result of attaching a meaning to the synaptic name, what sort of thing is it that we want to be attaching? Okay, and it's meant to be meaning, but can we regard what we have as meaning? Now, there are two natural requirements on meaning that is so attached. The first is that, like cash, it should be freely transferable, so that the meaning attached to the one new name, uninterpreted name, can also be attached to any other new name. This is as in Kripke. Kripke says, look, you know, whatever, if I could have called this sentence Harry. Okay, so whatever, if I'm from a semantical point of view, whatever meaning I attach to Jack, I should also be able to attach to Harry. The other requirement is that, again, something like cash, the meaning should be redeemable, in that the meaning of the name should be determinate of its reference. It should, so that's the cash value, so to speak, of meaning. It should, that is to say, somehow be possible on the basis of the meaning of an I name to determine its reference. Now, this account fails to satisfy both these requirements. For one thing, the interpretation is one which assigns an object to the uninterpreted expression. So it's not appropriately wedded to any other interpreted expression. Okay. So that's one difficulty. And the other is that if we now, instead of attaching the interpretation to the expression, we attach its referent, which is the natural thing to do, because the referent then could be attached to any expression, we face a vicious circle, because the whole point of attaching a meaning to the expression was to give an account of what the semanticized interpreted expression was. But here we're now just presupposing that we know what it is. So we're given no real account of what this new thing is. Okay, so that doesn't work. Okay, another option is this. And this is what I call self-reference through definition. And the idea is, okay, I'll read it because it'll probably be just as quick. The quotation from Kripke suggests another way in which semanticized self-reference might be achieved. For Kripke, okay, I have to stop at more or less 4:15, don't I? So I'm just thinking now about how to do all this. Okay, so the other way is through definition. And if you go to the handout, you'll see the definitional route to self-reference. Okay, so it may be worth just looking at that. There are just, it's two-thirds of the way down. And so I've simplified Kripke's example. So Kripke has Jack being the name of the sentence, Jack is short. I'm here having Jack being the name of Jack. Not the sentence Jack is short, but the name of Jack. Okay. Now, if we just take this
proof of the fact that we want to give a definition, and we want it to follow from this definition, or stipulation, that Jack, in quotes, names Jack. Okay. So here's a little proof. Here's my definition. Jack is, by definition, Jack, in quotes. Okay. So I'm just saying that's how I understand Jack. So from, if this is a successful definition, it should follow that Jack equals Jack. Sorry, that Jack equals, quote, Jack. And from that, by principle of semantic sense, it should follow that Jack, in quotes, names Jack. Now, there's the following thought, which is this. This, under the, what I call the informal understanding of definition, where we're updating interpretations, this proof, it seems to me, goes through. Okay. And the thought now is, look, whenever we have this formal use of language, it can be replaced by a corresponding natural use of language. Instead of having this external interpretation, the interpretation could be incorporated into the use of language. And so we should be able to read this proof as a proof that bold Jack, in quotes, names bold Jack. Okay. Because everything gets semanticized. Okay. Okay. The difficulty is that it's, for reasons that should be evident to you, it's actually hard to see how this little proof can be semanticized. Because we really face a choice. When we semanticize, take that first thing when I say Jack equals Jack, either both Jacks are semanticized, in which case there's a circular definition, or just the first one is semanticized, in which case, in the next line, we're only justified in saying semanticized Jack is equal, in quotes, unsemanticized Jack, and so we don't get what we want. So this doesn't seem to be a reasonable way of, even though you might think that we can always semanticize what we do, that doesn't seem to be a reasonable way of doing it. Okay. All right. What I want to suggest is that that these difficulties can be overcome, and both of them can be overcome. So let me just briefly, I won't read out what I have here. But one question is this. If I've got semanticized Jack, that is the I name Jack, how can I regard it as a result of a marriage between unsemanticized Jack and some meaning? What can that meaning be? And the suggestion I want to make is that that meaning is what I call self-referentiality. Okay. What is self-referentiality? It's a function, we can represent it at least, as a function taking any expression into itself. Okay. Now, this function, when you wed it, when there's this marriage, this function has to be understood in a very particular way. So what we have is we have this marriage between unsemanticized Jack and this feature, self-referentiality, which I think of as a function. And what we must now think of is that when it comes to reference, the way we determine reference is by taking that function and applying it not to unsemanticized Jack, but to semanticized Jack. That's applying it to the very expression that results from the marriage of the two. Okay. That's how it must be regarded. Okay. And this is what I've called here an ostensive meaning function. Okay. So I'm going to be very brief here. And this is one of the places where we have to radically liberalize our conception of meaning. Normally, we think of meaning and syntax as running on parallel tracks. So when I've got a term, that has some kind of functional meaning, like a predicate, okay? So we represent the meaning as a function. We normally think that that function is looking, thinking of it as a reference, thinking of meaning here as reference, let's say. We're thinking of that function as looking for the reference of some other term. That's what it's doing. Say it's a functional meaning. So at syntactic level, this expression is combining with some other expression to produce a complex expression. And at the level of meaning, what we have then is a function. Meaning is then given by a function, which then looks for the reference of some other expression. Okay. When I talk about ostensive meaning, these are meanings that aren't looking for reference at all. They're looking for bits of language. They're looking back, they're looking at the syntax. Okay. So if this is a huge departure from the normal way of regarding a meaning. The thought is that there are these meaning functions which, so to speak, from a usual point of view, are improperly looking at expressions themselves. Okay. And although I used to think, you know, we have to work according to the usual guidelines, there seems to be now nothing to prevent there being this broader conception of what meaning might be. Okay, so there's syntax and semantics kind of now interact in a certain way. And this meaning that we're now wedding to the uninterpreted expression is a meaning of this sort. It's an ostensive meaning where the way it gives you reference is by looking not at the reference of some other term, but at the very term itself. Okay. All right. And I have a similar view of quotation, that the quotation marks have what I call an ostensive meaning. So what I try to do, first of all, I'm being very brief here, is I try to give an account of how we can regard the semanticized name Jack as a result of wedding it, the unsemanticized Jack, with a certain meaning, where that meaning is what I've called self-referentiality, which is, an ostensive meaning. And the way I deal with the case of definition very loosely is this. Go back to, if I can find it now, I've lost my own bit of the handout. Well, I don't need to, is it here? Oh, it doesn't matter. Remember that little proof that Jack names Jack, and there's the initial definition here, that Jack is by definition, in quotes, Jack. And what I want to do is to regard that as an implicit definition. So what we want is that identity, Jack equals quote Jack, to be true. And how is it to be made true? Not by updating an interpretation. What we want is to put in a semanticized name here. The requirement is that Jack should be, bold Jack should be semanticized in such a way that as a result of being semanticized, Jack, bold Jack that is equal to, in quotes, bold Jack is true. That's how the definition works. So it's an implicit definition of Jack. Now, whenever you have an implicit definition, there's a question as to whether it actually serves to define. That is there a unique semanticized name of this sort? Because the definition can only work if there is. And what I'm saying is, yes, we can think of there being a definition here, but it comes with a presupposition, namely that there is such a name. Now, you may have other reasons for thinking that there is, and that this model of Jack being endowed with meaning gives you such a model. But the point is that we can think of there being a semanticized version of this piece of reasoning, but unlike the unsemanticized version, it rests upon a certain presupposition, a quite substantive presupposition. All right, I want to come to the second part. I went over this very briefly. I want to come to the second part of the talk, which is a theory of semanticized reference. Okay. And as far as I'm aware, no one's developed a theory of this. But maybe Martin Pleitz has in a certain sort of way, but I'm not sure it's a theory in the sense that I have in mind. So this is in the handout, okay. And I think this theory brings out very nicely the distinction, where there is, so to speak, a real division between a straightforward theory of semanticized reference and one that involves these problematic assumptions. Okay. So this is meant to be a formal theory. So there actually are, in this theory, there are three kinds of object or item. There are individuals, you know, like you and me. And then there are inscriptions, which are uninterpreted bits of language. And then there are interpreted expressions. So there are these three objects. Okay. And the theory relates these three kinds of objects. The theory I am developing here is one that just has names in it. Now, there should be a corresponding theory that has predicates in it. This is much more difficult. Much more difficult. Okay. The theory with names in it does not have to confront the paradoxes, actually. So self-reference for naming is not in itself paradoxical. Self-reference for predicates is. And so when it comes to the theory for predicates, we have to confront the paradoxes. And I have a view as to how that might be done, but that's not, I'm going to talk now about this relatively unproblematic theory. Okay. And I think it's interesting that naming in itself, even self-referential naming, seems to me is not paradoxical. Okay. All right. So the theory has two primitives. One is the notion of a basis. So I'm thinking of an inscription as being the basis for a semanticized expression. Okay, so I take Bold Jack. The basis for Bold Jack is Bear Jack. Okay. So, all right. And then the other notion is reference. That and on this view, it's only semanticized expressions that refer. Unsemanticized expressions simply do not refer. Okay. All right. So, I'm going to have to skip some of the things. So these two primitives allow you to actually define more than you might think you can define. There are two really important principles, axioms in this theory. And there's something which I call the minimal theory, which doesn't make any problematic assumptions. So it's, I think of it as completely, it should be completely unproblematic. One is the principle which I call nominal existence. And what this says is if you take any item whatever, and you take any bare name, you can find a semanticized name whose reference is that object. That is, the semanticization name will have as its basis the bare name, and it will refer to the object. So I can use any bare name I like to refer to anything I like. That's the idea.
Okay.
This is the Harry, this is Kripke's Harry principle. I could have used Harry to refer to this sentence. I can use any name I like to refer to anything I like.
Okay.
Of course, people might think, you can't refer to anything. Some people think you can't refer to God. How they manage to say that, I don't know. But okay. But for simplicity, we're kind of idealizing it. I guess you could have a theory in which some objects can't be referred to. Okay. All right. And that's one principle. And the other principle is an identity principle. And I'm here assuming a kind of million view of names. This would have to be modified if you didn't. And this is what I call nominal identity. And this says that if you've got two semanticized names, they're the same if their basis is the same and if their reference is the same. In other words, I could have the semanticized name Jack that refers to an individual. There aren't two names, semanticized names Jack, that refer to that individual. There's just There's just one. And again, this might be this. You can come up with clever counterexamples to that, but at least within this simple theory, that's what we have. Okay. All right. Now, what's nice about this theory is that, first of all, there's an axiom you can add saying that, a kind of closure axiom saying that the only names there are the ones that you can prove to exist using nominal existence. Okay. And it's provable that none of those names is self-referential. So the only names guaranteed to exist by this theory, none of them are self-referential. None of them are cyclical. There are no infinite referential chains. So there's nothing in this theory that will enable you to establish that the such things exist. Okay. And the only reasonable extension of the, there's an extension of the theory which enables us to get these things. Okay. And so we need, as it, so to speak, from the point of view of this theory, some further substantive assumptions. So I've tried to lay down what these substantive assumptions are. And this involves a bit of terminology, I'm afraid. So first of all, there's the idea of a referential chain. So I've got a name here that refers to something. So the object it refers to, I can put after. Then the object it refers to may itself be a name, so perhaps it refers. And I can keep going on in this way. Perhaps I go on forever, but perhaps I stop with something that doesn't refer. And that could be either an inscription, because inscriptions only refer, or it could be an individual. Okay, that's a referential chain. Okay. Now there are proto-referential chains, and in proto-referential chain just consists of inscriptions, with the possible exception of the very last member, which could be an individual. Okay. So it's just a sequence of these uninterpreted symbols, names, possibly terminating with an individual, possibly not, possibly just terminating with an uninterpreted name. Okay. Now, corresponding to any referential chain is a proto-referential chain. So, I've got the referential chain. I just strip. All those semanticized names of their meaning and get the proto-referential chain. That's how I do it, okay? So in that case, when there's that relationship between the two, I say that the referential chain realizes the proto-referential chain. It realizes it. This is how this proto-referential chain could be realized, okay? And we need two assumptions now in this new theory. One is that every proto-referential chain, even if it's infinite, is realized. And the other is that a proto-referential chain never gets realized in more than one way. It's only one way. And these correspond to the nominal identity and existence claim. Now, if you take these new principles, which concern the relationship between referential chains and proto-referential chains, and restrict them to the finite case, to the case when the chains are finite, those principles can be proved in the minimal theory. So what the new theory adds to the minimal theory is the fact that these principles also hold for infinite chains. Okay. So let's look at two particular applications. Here's one proto referential chain. Jack, 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 Jack. Ad infinitum. Okay. Now, if I had a finite number of Jacks, if I had Jack, 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 the realization of this would be a name Jack that refers to a name Jack that refers, by a gen name here I mean a bold name, that refers to a bear, that refers to Bear Jack. So I'd have bold Jack referring to a bold Jack that refers to a bear Jack. And these actually all have to be distinct. They're provably distinct. Okay. Now the question, and similarly when I have a finite chain of a longer length, I'm going to get this tower, so to speak, of Jacks, where the referential chain terminates in an uninterpreted Jack. Now suppose I have now infinite one, sequence of these jacks. Okay. How does that get realized? Well, there's jack. There has to be bowl jack. And what's bowl jack referring to? It's referring to something realized by what follows jack in that sequence, which is the very same, by identity, is the very same thing. There's only one thing it can be. The thing is, if I lop off the first term of that sequence, I get the very same sequence. And so whatever it is that's doing the realizing has to be the same. So what I get, according to these principles, I need identity here, because if this sequence could be realized in two different ways, it could be that the first jack refers to a different thing from the second jack, but it can only be realized in one way. So this infinite sequence of jacks then gives you self-referential jack. Okay. And similarly, with if we want to get something like Steve's case involves predicates in effect. If we imagine something like Steve's sequence where we have S1 referring to S2 referring to S3 and so on, just modify the case somewhat so we just have these names. Then to get an infinite sequence, someone's at the door. Okay, Ruth's dealt with it. We need this additional axiom to get this infinite referential chain. That is of semanticized names. So anyway, what I think this I think the real interest of this theory consists in extending it to the case of predicates. But at least this little theory here brings out very sharply the division. How we actually need further substantive principles governing reference to get either semanticized self-reference or ill-founded semanticized reference. And in actual fact, the underlying principle that you seem to need is the very same in both cases. That is the same general principle that gives you the one is going to give you the other. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.